Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Two Russians and two Frenchmen rule the day this week for your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra performances. To tell us about what you're going to hear are our guest conductor, Marcelo Leninger. Hello.
Hi. Good to be here again, Julia.
Great to have you back. And also joining us for the very first time, cellist Andrei Ionitsa. Hello, Andrei.
Hi. I'm very happy to be here.
So, let's talk about what we've got here. Have you two ever worked together before?
No,
not yet.
Not yet. So we just met today in the elevator when going to the lobby.
Yeah. While trying to be, you know, right on time.
But I heard wonderful things about Andrei, and we actually are going to work together not only this weekend here in Rochester, but already we have a scheduled concert in Grand Rapids when he'll be coming there as a soloist.
So this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
That's right.
Hopefully.
So let's look at the program. Did you have a hand in this program at all, Marcelo?
I think so. I to be quite honest, I don't remember when we put the program together. It's been over a year, maybe 2 years. I don't know. But I do remember that the Shostakovich was in place, and they sent me a list of pieces that they would like the orchestra to play, and I remember the Debussy Nocturnes was one of the pieces in the list, and I happened to love the piece, and I was going to conduct this season with other orchestras, so I thought it was a good fit. And going from there, then we always back and forth suggesting different openings and different pieces to include in the program. So that was, as I remember, was more or less the process.
Well, it's sort of a French bookend, so it ends with the Debussy, and we'll get to that. It begins with a really magical piece of music, Ravel's Mother Goose Suite.
Yeah.
This piece is so beautiful. Perhaps you want to give a little backdrop on it.
Well, it is a wonderful, wonderful piece of music. Ravel, it's definitely one of my favorite composers. When you're talking about orchestration, I mean, he's a master. The way he used the orchestra, all the colors and all the possibilities of the orchestra, he was really incredible in terms of an orchestrator. This piece, though, was composed for piano four hands, and it's pretty much a piece for children. Ravel loved children. You know, he liked interacting with them and discovering the world. I think he considered himself a children at heart. And he had wonderful friends, and that actually he ended up composing this piece to their children. But later on, of course, the piece was arranged for piano solo and then for the orchestra. And then Ravel did a ballet version of the piece and included more music to it. It's just one of those magical moments of Ravel's composition.
I was really trying to capture a moment. Each one is capturing a moment. You gave that sort of, I don't know about that easy made-for-children thing, Andre. Did you ever play this when you were playing
piano? I did play it on the piano, actually. You know, I started with the piano when I was 5, and then 3 years later I switched to cello, but I still kept on, you know, practicing piano, you know, the highest level I could regarding my time. You know, I remember actually even when you know, my teacher introduced me to the piece, that it might look easy, but of course it's actually not very easy music. It's very profound, and at the same time it's full of character. Sometimes it's even tragic. Mm-hmm. You know, even though this sort of naivety in the music language doesn't necessarily show it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not my place to talk about the orchestral.
No, but that's a really good point. Sometimes we have this thought of music for children, with some kind of children element or theme to it, will be easy music. That's not true, because sometimes the way composers try to understand the complexity of the children's world and imagination and creativity, it makes a piece very profound, as he said.
And there's this very, sort of purity about this work.
True.
Were these all written at once? They weren't. Did Ravel conceive of this as a suite from the get-go, or did he write these sort of one at a time and eventually connect them?
I think he conceived as a suite, the five pieces was part of a suite, as I believe. I'm not 100% sure on that. You know, composers, they have some kind of sketch somewhere, and they use that in a piece, or they have an idea they're supposed to use in another piece, and they put in a piece. They're always playing a little bit with that. But
Andre says, you know, points this great point out that this sounds so easy when you hear it on the piano. It sounds so easy when you hear the orchestra play. Is the music actually easy for the orchestra to play?
No, it's not easy. And there are many, I mean, I could go on and tell you all the technical aspects of how the piece is difficult in terms of intonation, in terms of finding the right colors, in terms but I would say the main difficulty of the piece is just to try to find the right character, the right mood, respecting the traditions and respecting, you know, especially when you're starting a program with it, because it starts very soft and very calm. So just to find that right atmosphere right away, it makes very challenging.
But it ends in this huge and glorious explosion.
Yeah, not even an explosion, just kind of a magical kind of a universe of sound that Ravel was so master in doing it.
And no sooner have we been taken into this magical world than you completely blow it apart with the Shostakovich Cello Concerto Number 1, and with, of course, Andre as the guest soloist. This really actually does start with a bang. This one is right out of the box. It is an explosion, a simultaneous explosion with your orchestra and your cello. And as I listen to it, it always occurs to me that that has got to be one of the roughest starts for a concerto that's available.
It's easy for me because he starts the concerto, so
exactly.
He set the tone and the tempo, and I just follow it.
Yeah. In a way, It is terrifying, you know, just for the soloist to start the concerto, you know, right away with a couple of solo notes. But on the other hand, it's me who actually has the choice to just give energy to the whole piece from the get-go. And you know, at the same time, of course, when you wait for 3 or 4 minutes, like in the Dvorak concerto, just to even start the first theme, it can get terrifying, you know, on stage. just this whole waiting. For me, Shostakovich is probably the closest composer to my heart. I feel like I can relate to this passion. Of course, his music speaks a lot about tragedy. But at the same time, there's always this ray of light and of hope in his music. And on top of it was so intelligently written. There's not one single note that was not very well thought.
He wrote this for one of the greatest cellists ever, Mstislav Rostropovich.
Yeah.
Rostropovich memorized it in 4 days and had it ready to go.
That's how the story goes.
So how many days did it take you?
Me, well, you know, when you play one of these very standard concertos, you kind of already know the music by heart before you even start practicing it. I mean, I gotta be honest. This has been a gift to me as well. I can learn things very easily and also memorize them. So there's not necessarily a problem for me. But I mean, I've been practicing this piece since I was probably, you know, 17. Like I played the first movement even way back, just because I love the music so much. And for the first time, I got to play it on stage at I think around 20, and I felt like the music just fell in the right place from the very first moment to the last one.
So you don't necessarily memorize your concertos when you go out to play them?
Oh, well, of course, I do learn them by heart. But for me, it's more of a process that happens automatically. Mm-hmm. It's just that if I practice a passage, if I repeat it a couple of times, it just stays automatically in my head.
So you say that this is really, really close to your heart. What specifically is it about this concerto,
yes,
that specifically speaks to your heart, Andre?
I'm not talking only about the concerto. I'm talking about him as a composer.
Yeah.
His sonata, I've always had very, very special moments on stage with his music. I remember even during the Tchaikovsky competition, during the second round, I played the sonata, and around the third movement, I just started tearing up for the very first time ever on stage. The atmosphere became really electric. I felt that there was some sort of spirits going around in the hall.
Shostakovich had a really, really difficult life. It did not go well for him in his homeland.
Not always, yeah.
And so I ask you, why did he stay when he was being blacklisted, when he was being persecuted, haunted by the cultural committee? Why?
Well, what else can you do when you have this huge gift?
You could go to a new country.
Well, I think there's, you know, Russians also take a lot of pride in not only in their own cultures and values, but in the places as well. I can say that even I'm not genetically Slavic, you know, but of course I grew up in this sort of post-communist, post-Sovietic atmosphere as a Romanian. And somehow I had this feeling like even the earth beneath me belonged to me. And I'm sure it's even harder to be displaced from your own home country, even if you're scrutinized and put under so much trouble, especially because his music is so, in a way, so deeply Russian that, yeah.
I think also Shostakovich, especially with the Fifth Symphony, when he composed that, I think he found a way through irony or through other tools that he found to compose music to send a message, certainly a political message, and in a way that it was not complete. It was not in your face. That it's a lot about the Fifth Symphony is about that. Not only that was the symphony that actually pleased people in the party and the military, and they thought, okay, finally he's composing something that is nationalistic, and it's, you know, and they're pleased with it. Even though that symphony, there's so many hidden messages about the political situation in that country at that time. And so part of his persona and part of his being, I think, was to find those tools that he could convey his message about his country and being there, not writing that kind of music from America or South America or other places in Europe, but being there, feeling, you know, the fear, the anxiety, the terrible moments they were going through, and find a way to send a message in a hidden way so he wouldn't be banned again as a composer as he was in the past. So that really is, I think, it's incredible thing that he ended up doing it. Not only that, but also everything else he was doing there. I mean, he was incredible film composer, you know, an improvisator. He did that in the movie theaters with us, you know, playing for movies.
Now they say that the first movement of this cello concerto is the hardest first movement.
Who says that?
I read I read a cellist who said this was the hardest cello. This was the hardest first movement of any cello concerto available. Do you agree? It doesn't sound like you do.
I think, let's put it this way. When you want to play an instrument, you know, at the highest level, and actually to when you want to present a work, and it's really in and to take it to its deepest and most honest form, you cannot even say that this piece is harder than the other. Mm-hmm. I would say then, of course, on a technical level, this concerto might be a bit more challenging than let's say a Saint-Saëns. Of course, it's extremely tiring. Think about the what comes actually after the first movement, which, in my opinion, is actually the most comfortable movement of the of the work. You have the second movement, which goes straight to the cadenza, straight to this grueling last movement. You're tumbling down to, you know, to death.
Why do you consider the final movement grueling?
It goes extremely fast. It's not easy to put together with the orchestra. You'd almost never have a moment of rest, and it's sort of this roller coaster that never stops.
This was written for Rostropovich, as I said earlier. Now, as you listen to this piece, as you play it, and of course, we have many recordings of Rostropovich available. We can hear him play at any time. But do you, when you play this, get sort of an insight to the internal life of Rostropovich as an artist, of who he was as a cellist beyond his simple, obvious, fabulous technical prowess?
Well, I do love Rostropovich, and I do love his playing and have loads of respect for him. And, you know, like the first recording I ever listened to, you know, with this concerto was his. But to be honest, when I try to approach pieces, I sort of go with my personal instinct and with my inner voice. And I think definitely this concerto was more than a show for Rostropovich. But as I said before, whenever I play Shostakovich's music, I just feel this very special connection. Like every phrase flows naturally.
What about the orchestral part for this concerto? How is that?
Well, I start saying as Andrew just just said about the fact that every single note in this concerto is really well thought, and that's totally true. I mean, there's nothing there that is strange or weird. I mean, it's really well structured.
He managed to write a whole concerto as other works, you know, just out of a single motive. Basically.
Yeah, which is pa-pa-pa-pam, and which he starts the piece.
Exactly.
But the thing is, the structure of the piece and the choice of the instrumentation and all that is really well done. What is unusual about this concerto is that the third movement is actually the cadenza. So the whole third movement, he's playing alone as a cadenza.
Same thing happens in the violin concerto.
In the violin concerto.
But that one has an extra movement.
And then you go from that directly to the fourth movement, which is the more complicated one in terms of synchronization with soloists and orchestra. So it makes hard because of that. To put it together and to be well and to be precise and to be well played.
At the same time to have loads of energy, maybe even more energy than you had before in the cadenza, which is anyway long and tiring,
yeah,
and challenging.
So that's the challenging part. But again, you're dealing with a score that is so well fought and it's really, really wonderful written.
And when it's visceral. It's not necessarily complicated music.
Yeah,
some people feel like they should make something, extraordinary about it. The music is just there.
Yeah.
One of the lovely things about this, too, is that interplay between the cello and the horn.
Yes.
Horn players.
And other instruments.
And other instruments. So where will we find that happening?
The first movement, of course, where the, you know, in the recap, the horn takes over the second theme, which is to be played by the cello in the exposition, and there are lots of wonderful horn solos in the first movement as well. The last one too, actually, right before the coda, the horn announces the sort of coming back to the very first theme, tam bam bam bam, in a way fabulous but also very dramatic fashion.
After we finish this particular concerto, we take a break and we all breathe because we're exhausted. For you, Andre, after that, and we come back with a piece of music that actually we tend to associate with Halloween. We don't tend to associate it with this time of year at all. And that is Mussorgsky's A Night on Bald Mountain. He wrote this when he was quite young, correct?
Correct, yeah. Mussorgsky, he's a very interesting composer because he was very creative, very prolific in a way, but he left many works unfinished. He just, you know, he would compose something and not even orchestrate or... So a lot of his contemporary colleagues, they did some orchestrations, or of course, composers after Mussorgsky did some wonderful orchestrations. And this is one of the cases. The version we're doing here is the Hymns Kosakovich version, which is Rimsky Korsakov, which is the I would say the most well known of the versions. There are others, believe it or not, but this is the most well known. And of course, he was in Fantasia, and it became a popular piece of music.
It was rejected, though, and that I found very interesting. That when Balakirev heard it, he refused to play it, and it was set aside, never to be played again ever in Mussorgsky's life. He never got to hear this played in concert. I think this was probably one of the very worst calls that Balakirev ever made. Why did he dislike it? I've always been baffled by that.
Well, so many masterpieces people dislike by the time they're composed or premiered. I mean, one of my favorite pieces of music, which is The Rite of Spring, Stravinsky, had a terrible reaction when it was premiered.
You mean that little riot that broke out? That's nothing major.
Not major. But, you know, I do believe that we tend to understand pieces and some of the compositions many, many years after they're actually written. And Kosakovsky, actually, Rimsky Korsakov, himself, I think it was not something he really admired in terms of the piece itself. But then he discovered by, you know, arranging and putting the orchestration together, that was a wonderful piece.
Finally, we finish off with Debussy's three nocturnes, lovely, gorgeous pieces, Clouds, Festivals, and Sirens. Three-tone poems all put together. Were these created, Marcello, to be put together, or... Because sometimes suites are created all at once and sometimes they are not. Was this created all at once?
The last movement, I think, came later, which actually is the one that includes the women singers as part of the orchestra. So it's not a chorale piece, but of course the Debussy used the female voices more or less representing the mermaids, and he used that as a extra texture, extra color to the piece, which is actually wonderful. But the piece, you know, one of the things I loved about Debussy is you know, his creativity when he's composing something based on a painting or based on other art forms and transform that in music. I remember there was a great Brazilian-French pianist. Her name is Magda Tagliaferro. She actually met Debussy. She lived in Paris, and she met Debussy, and she was a wonderful artist that play a lot of Debussy piano music. And she wrote a book, and she made a very interesting comment about that music and that period of music, which is, if you make an analogy of the paintings of that time and the Impressionism, a lot of people say that, you know, looking at an Impressionist painting, it's like you're looking this beautiful view through a blurry window. She actually said that this it should not apply to music. In music, it's like you look in this beautiful view from a crystal clear window, and with your imagination and with your eyes, yourself has to blurry that, and yourself has to create this kind of dreamy and blurry atmosphere. And I thought that was really interesting because it gives you a different approach to interpreting this kind of music that is not only about effects and colors. It's about precision, and it's about exploring details in the score with the motor or Haydn-like precision. And after you master that, then you create the textures, and then you create the effects, and then you create the colors. And I thought that was a really interesting approach to this music.
Talk to me about each of these movements, beginning with Nuages, Clouds.
Debussy actually wrote his own explanation about each movement. I couldn't say exactly his words, but Clouds, he imagined that more or less as a dance of the clouds, and how the light reflects on the clouds. Light being the moonlight, being whatever light can be in the sky at night. So then it's much more about the light effects that you can experience by observing the sky than really clouds itself.
Can we hear a specific instrument illustrating that light, or is it just a tone that we hear?
I think it's more a tone. If for some reason there is an instrument that is supposed to represent that, then I need to study a little bit more about that. But and Debussy sometimes he's not so in this piece particularly. He was not so, the program of the music is not so in your face. It served a purpose. The paintings, as well as his imagination for each movement, served more a kind of inspiration of the mood and the atmosphere of the piece.
The second movement is Fête or Festivals. Mm-hmm. And how does he draw a painting of the festivals for us?
Same thing. It's about this kind of a movement of the air and stars and clouds and in the sky, basically.
So it's more of it's less of a festival in a town?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not. Although there's a moment in the piece that the trumpet starts, and there's this moment of the trumpet that he called that should be like a procession. But that's it. That's all the hint he gave us. It's a procession. It's not a procession of what. A procession of, I mean, what kind of procession? I'm not sure. But I think his imagination for the piece was much more about the natural elements of the sky and the lights than Beethoven's in Pastoral Symphony as a festival in a given village.
And then we end up with the women who will lure your ship onto the rocks.
That's right, the mermaids.
The sirens. This one is actually in the ultimately very specific to the sirens. This is the one time it feels to me less like light and effect and more like actual breathing sentient beings.
True. But the interesting thing about it is that his approach to that, it's more, again, of the idea of how he got inspired by that for the music. Because if you think about the seductive possibilities of a mermaid and what they do to the person that they seduct at the end, which is killing that person, basically, that's not in the case of this particular movement. It's much more about the charm and kind of the your imagination in terms of the movements of the water or of their singing or of their swimming and more that than in terms of seducing and giving man and killing him afterwards.
Leaving us with a gentle way to walk out of the audience, out of the hall that night.
Very true. And what I love about this program is that, you know, it gives an opportunity for the audience members to experience music that you don't hear every day in the concert hall. You know, you have a very popular piece, which is Mussorgsky, but then all the other pieces, I wouldn't say they're rarely played, but they're not as often as Beethoven Fifth or, you know, a Dvořák symphony. And also it makes you listen music in a different way because you have the French beginning, you have the Russian middle section, and then you finish with another French piece. All of the pieces more or less composed, you know, they're composed at the end of 19th century, beginning of 20th century. And then you leave the concert hall not with a big bang or a great triumphal ending, but a soft ending that, you know, it makes you kind of leave the concert hall with this imagination of sounds and that can be as effective as if you leave a concert hall after a big finale of a Mahler symphony.
Or Shostakovich 5.
So Andre said he started with the piano and moved to the cello. What did you play when you were a kid?
Violin and piano. So those are my major instruments.
You still play?
I still play piano a little bit, but I don't have time to practice both instruments anymore. And violin, I mean, when you don't practice violin, you lose the technical possibilities very, very fast.
Was it difficult for you, Andre, to give up the piano and to stick with the cello?
You know, it was the idea of my piano teacher to study a string instrument. She said that there are, you know, enough pianists in this world anyway. And, well, she told me and my family that I have a very good pitch, and it would be a shame not to study a string instrument instead. I was around 8, 9 when we decided for this. I was in my third grade, and this is actually the perfect start for cello because your hands also need to be, you know, slightly larger to grasp all of the positions. And I can say that from the very first lesson, I fell in love with cello instantly. Although I'm still a pianist at heart, yeah. I mean, I do consider myself a bit of a frustrated pianist still.
Tell me about your cello.
I'm playing Giovanni Battista Rogeri from the year 1671. It belongs to a wonderful foundation in Hamburg, Germany. It's called Deutsche Stiftung Musikleben. Oh, in English translation, you know, German Foundation for Music Life.
Will you have to give it back?
Unfortunately, yes, when I turn 30.
Wow.
But I still have 6 years to go with it.
That's going to be tough. This will be 6 years of your other half. I mean, that cello is an extension of your arm, of your heart.
Yeah, although my big love is not for a particular music instrument in itself, but rather for music as a phenomenon. This is why we even call them instruments, because this is just an auxiliary we use to express feelings, emotions, and so on. Of course, I do love cello, especially because it's so close to the human voice, as everybody says. And it's, you know, it's the instrument that brought me so many wonderful moments on stage. But my very deep love is still for music.
And in the end, there will always be another cello.
Yeah, or a piano, or, you know, or a baton, who knows.
I want to thank you both very much for spending time with us on this podcast. We've been talking to Marcelo Leninger and Andrei Ionitsa, and they are soloists, well, your conductor and soloist with your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra this week. If you'd like information about the RPO season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres, and this podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.